Hello and welcome to another podcast from Books of the Year, a podcast about books that comes out once a year.
It sort of comes out a little bit more frequently than that, yes.
Thank heavens for that.
Yes, yes.
We're going to be talking to Anthony Horowitz on the show today, so stand by for Anthony. Ruth has sent in an email. Dear memoir and autobiography, I heard you which they're kind of the same.
One of them... Yes, I think.
More anecdotal, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
As I sit back and reflect on my life.
Is that chapter one of yours? Oh, lovely. Yeah,
yes. Wearing a dressing gown and that kind of thing. I heard you recently discuss whether to start at the beginning of a series of books or dive in with the latest one. I don't have a particularly strong opinion either way, but I recently discovered Michael Connelly, last week's guest on the pod, obviously. Uh-huh. I know you talk a lot about his Bosch books, but I actually started reading his Lincoln Lawyer series. They are brilliant. I'm instantly hooked. Now, I started reading these from the beginning, and I have to say, I think this is the best way to read them. I've no doubt that they could stand alone, or the readers can pick up on the details from earlier books, but the enjoyment for me comes from the character development, so I would recommend reading these books particularly in order. Thank you for your brilliant pod and recommendations. Actually, it's worth discussing that with Anthony, because this is book six.
Yeah.
So we will pick that up. But Ruth, thank you. And yeah, I guess ideally you want to start at the beginning, I suppose.
But isn't that how you've read the Michael Connelly books? You've read them in order, haven't you?
No, I think I've gone back to the earlier Harry Bosch books.
Oh, right, okay.
Having started midway through. But Lincoln Lawyer, I'm up to date and in order, I think. But anyway, Ruth, thank you.
Yes, interesting. Grape Nut sent a message. Simon and Matt, I was inspired by your recent conversation with Bryony Gordon. What a breath of fresh air that woman is. I have been putting off getting back into running because of feeling self-conscious, but listening to Bryony changed something. 2 days ago, I took myself out for a couch to 5K run, and I felt so good for doing it. So thank you, Bryony, and thank you, Simon and Matt, for having such brilliant, inspiring guests. I'm going to buy Bryony's audiobook and listen to it while I am out running.
Excellent. Very good. You can email us at any time, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We love to know what you're reading and what you think about the
book
you're reading.
Yes.
And not about the world.
No.
We're on Instagram and Threads and Blue Sky at Books of the Year. And time now to speak to our best-selling author and screenwriter. All right, yes, our very special guest this week is none other than the superstar writer. That's how I always think of him, and that's Anthony Horowitz. Hello, Anthony, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you,
sir. I think of you as a superstar writer.
I think of you as a friend. We've known each other for so many years.
That's also true. But for the purposes of this podcast, you're a superstar writer.
Yes.
Well, you're very kind. I think I'm a writer who's been around for a very long time and has written a great many novels, and sort of eventually you sort of pass into a sort of a phase of, God, I've known this guy all my life. And if that makes me a superstar, then I'm all for it.
I've just done an interview for the film podcast about with Leah Woodall, who's in this new movie called Tuna. And the woman who's producing the podcast, who I worked with on the film podcast, she said, so where are you, because it was quite difficult to arrange all, she said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to interview Anthony Horowitz. She went, you're kidding. Oh, no, no. And she grew up with Alex Rider.
Wow.
You know, it was like, she was so excited.
But you know, that is one of the nice things of my life, which is to meet lots and lots of people in the media who started reading Alex Rider. And I like to think that I've been a sort of a molecule in their bloodstream for their whole lives, which maybe has sort of pointed them in this direction. Or, of course, into MI6, he being a 14-year-old spy.
Absolutely.
But that is nice. Now, I want to say as well that I did love Tuna. What a great film.
Yes. We could talk about that, or...
my publishers will be delighted if I spend the entire interview talking about somebody else's work.
Anthony has written a fantastic... In fact, it says on the back, this is kind of Matt's thing, Hawthorne and Horowitz are back. The book is called A Deadly Episode. Matt will describe the cover. Here we go.
So, background of gold, and against that background of gold, we've got right in the centre a movie clapperboard that we'll all be familiar with from movie sets, except this clapperboard in its jaws has actual teeth and blood dripping down from the teeth. How do you investigate your own murder, it says on that clapperboard. Anthony Horowitz's name in, are we going to say teal? I'm going to say teal at the top.
Yeah.
A Deadly Episode in blood red at the bottom, and then at the top, Sunday Times says the master of the mystery, Richard Osman, says an absolutely wonderful writer.
Both of those are true. As another quote from Richard Osman, I'll have to have a word with Rich yes, next time.
Get Richard on.
Yeah, yeah. So this is book six in the series.
Indeed.
We've just had an email from a listener who we were talking to Michael Connolly about his books and his new series. And we were talking about joining an is it possible to join a series halfway through? Do you have to go back to the beginning? And it seems particularly appropriate for this. That you obviously want to fill in the blanks so we can join at any stage. But is it your feeling that really you need to start at the beginning?
Not entirely, no. I mean, you can read them. They are all standalone mystery stories and you know, always the murderer is revealed at the end and that's the end of that episode, deadly or otherwise. But there is an overriding arc, which is my attempt to try and find out where Hawthorne, the detective, has come from. He's a difficult and quite, you know, dangerous sort of individual, and something has clearly happened to him that has changed his life. It happened in Yorkshire, and it happened when he was a child. And in every book, I've been trying, as the writer inside the book, to find out what happened, and he won't say a word. And that arc does continue right through, and will only finish when the series does. And that is why it's quite a good idea to read the books in order. Mm-hmm. But that said, you can just start anywhere you like, because I always, always recap.
And for new arrivals, then, it's worth saying again that you are a character in this book.
Yes, that's right. I'm sort of the Watson to his Holmes, an idea which horrified my publishers when I pitched it to them quite a while ago now. They thought it would be an ego trip of some sort, but I would use the books only to sort of self-advertise and say how good my writing was. The exact opposite is true. The Anthony in the books is fairly idiotic. He's always five steps behind Hawthorne, never gets anything right, and ends up stabbed in two of the books in hospital. So not a great track record. But I love the role I have, which is instead of being the cleverest person, which is the writer who knows everything, including who the killer is before the killer even knows it, I am instead the sidekick who classically is always a bit dim. I mean, Watson I have to defend because he's brighter than people think, but Hastings, who works with Poirot, is you know, it has a low IQ, it has to be said.
Yes, okay, so just take us to where we are at the start of this book, which is even more meta than the one that you've just described.
Yes, it is complicated, and I have to say when I describe it, I worry I'm going to put people off reading it. It is an easy read, but it was a complicated thing to think up. What is happening in the opening of the book is that the first book in the series, which is called A Word is Murder, The Word is Murder, is being filmed by a not terribly good production company working in Hastings, which, on a biographical note, is where I filmed Foyle's War, yes, all those years ago. So there we are on the set of Foyle's War. Everything is going wrong. The producers run out of money. The film is over budget. The director is pretentious. The screenwriter hates detective stories and wants to turn it all into some kind of eco-statement. The two stars with each other's throats. And in the middle of all this, one of the stars is murdered, and Hawthorne and I have to investigate.
Yes. And, of course, anyone who's followed your work over many decades knows you're very familiar with the film set, and so we kind of love all those juicy details.
I want to ask about writers on film sets. So both of you, in fact, have been writers of works on film sets and visiting them. Now, the stereotype is always that the writer on the film set is sort of the lowest of the low. In other words, no one's really interested in them. And certainly in this book, Anthony, that's how your Anthony is treated, as this sort of thing that's getting in the way, really. So I suppose what I'm asking is, how close to reality is that in your experience?
Well, first of all, I have to remind you that I am not the writer of the script. This is Shanika Harris, who's been drafted in to write it. I am merely the visiting author of the book. And that is actually not true to my experience, because my wife, Jill Green, produces nearly all my TV work. So being married to the producer does give me a certain cachet.
Yeah.
And people tend to look after me quite nicely when I visit the set. That, unfortunately, is not something I do very often, because I do find myself in the way. If somebody's mobile phone goes off during a shot, it will almost certainly be mine. If somebody is in shot and is sitting sort of, you know, right in the middle of a scene, that will also be me. So I tend to avoid it. And also, it is true that although film sets look very quiet and nobody's doing anything, actually everybody is very, very busy. The pressure is on and tensions are running high. And the author has absolutely nothing to do. The screenwriter really has nothing to do either. And I think just makes people feel a bit nervous. So I tend to go. I was on the set of Marble Hall Murders, which is going to be on the BBC later this year, but that was in Corfu, and who would resist an opportunity to go out there? But by and large, I'll go maybe once, and that's it.
And do you find people are listening to you when you sort of voice opinions, when you say, actually, I'd rather it was done?
Matt, I never do that. I mean, it's impossible to do that. If you've got 60, 70 people working against the odds to get this thing on screen, they've got maybe 4 or 5 minutes of film, which doesn't sound a lot to produce in one day, but trust me, in America, it would be like 30 seconds or a minute a day. So you are really, really up against it. So some idiot wandering in and saying, actually, I'm not sure that a red hat suits that character is not going to be Mr. Popular.
Yeah. But how tempting is it to go, can I just say, when I, as the creator of this character, I don't think he'd have said that.
I never really offer anything. As I say, I just think my job is done. When I've handed over the screenplay, don't forget that I've been at the read-through, I've talked to the producer, I've talked to the director, I've often talked to the lead actors. So we're all agreed on things. Very, very occasionally somebody will come and ask me. I love that when on a set somebody comes up to me and says, look, we're doing this, what do you think? And I might say, no, don't do that because it'll give things away too much, or I really don't think that character would have spoken that way. And they're grateful because it's an interaction. But I think, as I say, being pushy and you know, and Mr. know or is not going to help.
There's a great section where, because obviously as you're in the book, you're also in the first of the books, which is being filmed, so who's playing you becomes an important role. And in the casting suggestion, this is a conversation from the book, they cast the net wide, but the names include Hugh Grant, Colin Firth, Lenny Henry, Hugo Weaving, Patterson Joseph, Neil Morrissey, Richard E. Grant, James Purefoy and Douglas Henschel. We did approach Vicky McClure. We assumed she would have met you on Alex Rider. That's just great fun, isn't it? Isn't that terrific?
Well, you missed the first half, which is that when they cast Hawthorne, actors are falling over themselves to play him. So even Daniel Day-Lewis says he'll come out of retirement and do it for half his usual rate if he can have the part. But then when they try to cast me, everybody turns it down. So that is... That's what I was saying at the beginning, but the Anthony in the books is no hero.
No. In fact, I just wondered whether there's any point where, you know, as you said, he's a little bit hopeless. And not properly hopeless, obviously, but he's so much not you, you know, that you are so much smarter than you are in the books. I wonder if there's any point we go.
That's one of the kindest questions I've ever been asked. How nice of you to put it that way. Yes, but the truth of the matter is, look, ask me about my writing and ask me how good I think I am as a writer, and I will probably embarrass you with my overweening arrogance. But as a sort of human being, when it comes to anything that isn't writing, that, you know, like, I don't know, programming the computer, trying to make sure that how does the television work, cooking, driving, you know, the everyday stuff of life, I'm just not that good at it. You know, I am a one-trick pony. I was very, very fortunate in that I was given this talent, this one talent, and have managed to, you know, build a whole life's career on it and still love it as much as the day I started. But I am aware that it is my own my only talent, and that if I were a sidekick in a murder mystery, or if I were a spy trying to work with Alex Rider, I would be hopeless.
But isn't it true? I've always thought that. So you mentioned Hastings before, and those sort of the sidekick who doesn't quite get it, who's behind it. I've always felt there is a purpose to that, because we as the reader, or we as, you know, if we're a viewer watching it, we like the idea we're slightly ahead of that guy. We're nowhere near as good as Holmes, or we're nowhere near as good as Miss Marple, but we are ahead of the slightly dim-witted partner.
I think that's spot on, Matt. I think that's absolutely the point of the sidekick, which is to be one behind the audience, and therefore to balance things a little bit, because the audience is so far behind the detective. But also, from the writing point of view, the sidekick is terribly useful. I've often said this about writing other murder mysteries, like working on Agatha Christie's Poirot, for example, on television, which is if the sidekick says, look over there, it means that whatever the main clue is in exactly the opposite direction. And therefore, the sidekick is a very, very good diversion thing, and always asks the wrong questions and interprets the answers incorrectly. So he's a very useful device to keep bewildering the reader.
Now, I want to talk about something that happens right in the centre of the book, and obviously for reasons of spoilers, we're not going to go into details into what happened, but there is a big scandal happens at the BAFTAs. Now, clearly, you wrote this way before we had our own big scandal at the BAFTAs, at the movie BAFTAs a few months ago. But it did strike me that here is a device of something dreadful happening to someone when they are at the point where all focuses on them because they're being praised for how well they've done, and then the worst possible thing happens. And obviously, you thought this up well before what happened at the BAFTAs. But it struck me as, what a great device. It's not enough that you're being humiliated, but you're being humiliated at the very time where you thought, I'm going to be recognised by my peers, I'm going to be applauded by my peers.
Well, one thing, Matt, it's not me who is the lead character in that particular chapter, which is my favourite chapter in the book, in many ways, because I've noticed that the Hawthorne books are getting funnier as I write them. Mm. I don't quite know why, yeah. But I'm sort of injecting a little bit more comedy. Now, this is a sort of a major comic scene, and the actor who is at the heart of it is the one playing me, so it's not in quite my humiliation. But I have been to the BAFTAs, and I've even gone up to the stage once at a BAFTA ceremony, and of course I was terrified that I was going to trip up or fall off the stairs as I went onto the stage, or some other sort of bodily malfunction might take place, because it's nerve-wracking and it's terrifying. You've got this big audience inside the hall, you've got another million or so people watching it. Of course, these days they do tend to have a time, you know, they can cut it if they want to, although they singularly failed to last time. It is a nerve-wracking experience. So I'm drawing on experience. I have to say also that I've never been a huge fan of awards, not in books, not in TV, not in film or anything, because, A, they seem to me to be... Well, let's be honest, I'm a bad loser. Let's start with that one. Okay. You know, I'm not good at grimacing and clapping my hands when somebody else has taken what should be mine. But also, it's not in the spirit of why I write books. I don't want a gong or a piece of plastic or a statuette to tell me my book is good. I want people like you to enjoy it, and people who are listening to this to just enjoy the books and to buy them. That's the sort of the name of the game. And you know, my wife Jill watches the Oscars and the BAFTAs, and she votes in them, and she talks about them, and she thinks about them. But I think to myself, you know, they're just a sideshow. And it's, you know, I always say, Alfred Hitchcock never won an Oscar.
Yeah.
And that, to me, just is the bottom line of it.
So I hadn't thought about this. Was this you sort of poking a stick at award ceremonies?
Perhaps? No, not really. I don't poke sticks. I don't use the books to sort of, you know, throw my views out there. I'm just mentioning it to you because we're talking about it now. But I wouldn't have written the chapter if I was in awe of the BAFTAs,
yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah. The BAFTA section is, it's almost like you woke up one morning and you said to Jill, I just had a nightmare. It's the kind of thing that, you know... Exactly as Matt says, on the one hand, great, I've won, but on the other hand, I'm never working again.
Well, it's a funny thing you should say that, because I did have that idea in bed, and I did wake up with it in my head, which often happens to me. I mean, you know, you're a writer too, Simon, so you must have had the similar experience where you are literally woken up in bed by an idea, and in my case, start giggling into the pillow. And I've just done a second book. I've just finished number 7 in the series, and I've done a second chapter, which actually does involve Jill, which makes the book number 6, the incident you're describing, seem actually quite normal, because this one is so out there. And again, it came to me in the middle of the night, and I'm lying in bed,
so it's not a,
and suddenly the thought, bang, and I almost had to get out of bed to write it.
So it's not a dream as such, it's just something...
Sometimes it can be a dream, but I think it's not. It's more like an outside interference, and I've sort of developed this theory that writers, to some extent, are like sort of radio receivers. Because I've already said that I'm not a particularly... I don't think of myself as being a particularly, you know, clever individual, you know, not in the sort of, you know, Stephen Hawking's use of that word. But sometimes, just out of the blue, an idea seems to fall into my head from somewhere. So it's like I'm a wireless receiver, a radio receiver, and this signal has come from another source. I'm not a particularly religious person or a particularly spiritual person, but it's a comforting feeling that there is something out there, and that writers, by our very nature, have that on switch always on to receive it.
So... If this is an awkward conversation, or if we're going too far into spoiler territory, then we'll
listen. I did a talk a couple of weeks ago, and I've been on the road with this book, and the person to me said, well, you know, what you obviously you're interested in this because the killer is that. I nearly had a heart attack on the stage, but I just managed to grit your teeth. Let's be careful.
Yeah, too late for that. Okay, no, but there is a part two. That's what I'm. In the book.
You're talking about Yorkshire.
Yes. So, in which the book, it doesn't stop, it sort of goes in a slightly different direction. Can you just explain why you decided to do
two reasons.
Like
that? I mean, I've already mentioned the fact that there is this ongoing arc, which is about Hawthorne. And we do know that Hawthorne was born in a place called Reeth in Yorkshire. I chose the name Reeth almost at random because it sounded like something you get at a funeral. So I thought that was quite good. But it's actually R-E-E-T-H. And with every book, we reveal a little bit more about the past. And I knew that in this book, I needed to go to Reith to actually look at the village where he was born. And it seemed to me to be a good idea because as much as films and sets and Hastings, which I love, were a great setting for the first 10, 12 or even more chapters, I did think we might get a little bit tired of it afterward. And it might be quite fun to actually leave that scene behind us and go somewhere completely fresh for the last third, as it were, of the book. And I also very much like, and this is a device that so many murder mystery writers use, of having a murder that took place 9 or 10 years ago, having reverberations that sort of, you know, involve the murder that is happening now. And I like the interplay between the two, particularly as this, in this case, it shows two completely different sides to Hawthorne.
Right. I really liked that particular part of the book, and I might be completely wrong on this, but I found it much darker than the other parts of the book. I mean, which is weird, given that there's literally a murder in the opening chapters of the book, but I found that section particularly dark.
Well, you're quite right, because one thing I've become aware of, and in fact I've really known from the start, is that what happened to Hawthorne 40 years ago, or 35, whatever it is, years back, is something quite dark. But, you know, to make him so difficult as a human being, and so lonely, and so close to being sad, he's not a sad character. I don't think you can have a detective who is just, you know, not fun to be with. But he is nonetheless sort of quite isolated and quite damaged. And I've when I started writing the series, I'm now on book 7, I sort of had half an idea of what it would be. I deliberately stopped myself thinking about it too much because I want these books to be fun. But the closer I get to the end and to the reveal of what happened in Reith when Hawthorne was 10 or 11 years old, the it's impossible to hold back that sense of foreboding, which I think is what you're picking up.
Yeah.
I wrote down some revelations about the Anthony Horowitz in the book, which I wondered if you have... if you are actually saying this is actually true, okay? So you just say whether this is...
Pretty much everything is true, Simon, so okay. Whatever it is.
So Anthony says, I know I can have an overactive imagination.
I'm plagued by my imagination. When I imagine something, it's immediately real or it's going to happen to me. So if I imagine something violent happening to me, which I do quite regularly, I then live in fear of it. So my imagination creates something which is never going to happen. I then fear it. So the answer to that one is yes.
Anthony says in the book, the worst thing about being a writer is fundamentally quite boring.
Yeah, that was actually perhaps not perfectly well expressed, because I love writing and I love every aspect
of it. I know
you
do.
But the truth is that by boring, I merely meant the sort of repetition of it, being the hours and hours I spend on my own in a room, the necessity to sort of look at a paragraph and realise you've used the word said too many times, or little, what's a better word for those things, or big, actually worse, big, grand, large, oversized, which one are you going to use? And sort of just, you know, pinning all these words down on the page, 82,000 of the little sods have got to sort of come from somewhere and be put into the book. And that is, in a way, boring. But I still love it. I think the two are not mutually exclusive.
Okay. The other one was, I'm quoting from the book here, I sometimes think that my entire life has been a fight with my younger self at prep school, public school, and then university, trying to find the person I wanted to be.
Yeah, I think that is 100% true. And it's one of those moments which I almost feel embarrassed about you plucking out, because, you know, I write those things and I hope that no one will notice. But but no, it's okay. I mean, it's just, you know very well that I had a horrendous 8 to 13 years old upbringing in a vile prep school, which did a lot of damage, which I've sort of had to sort of fold into my work. And I look at the young person I was and the dreams that I had, and I do think in a way that I'm still sort of fighting for what I wanted then, and may never achieve it. It's that, just the damage that can be done to us when we're young, which we never really get over.
So there is something that Horowitz mentions in the book, which I thought immediately cannot be you. And it's when he's having a conversation with this screenwriter, who, by the way, I thought was hilarious as well. The screenwriter desperate to get any kind of environmental message into what is a murder mystery. But anyway, she's talking about how she's done a number of scripts and not heard back. She'd done these scripts on spec, as they say, and nothing's come back. And you write, "I nodded, the great silence. All writers live on its other side." And I thought, that's a great line, and I bet it's an insight, but I struggle to think that that's you, Anthony.
No, it is true still. Less so, actually, in television and film. People tend to be quite quick. Film, television certainly. Television people are pretty quick with their responses. Maybe a couple of weeks in my cases. The faster the response, often the worse it is. You know, you prefer them to wait and think a little bit longer. Hold on, guys. But at the moment, Jill and I are trying to produce a play. I've written a new play. I've not yet been successful in the theatre, but I'm determined that this one is third time lucky, as it were. But it's been 5 months since I handed it in, and sometimes it can take 3 months for somebody. Theatre, for some reason, is unbelievably and painfully slow. I won't say rude, because I know these are busy people, but nonetheless,
it's rude.
You know, yes, I'm going to say it's rude. Okay, it is, actually, it is. Because you can read, the play is quite short. It's only about sort of 40 or 50 pages long, so it's,
so why is that taking so... I mean, is this just peculiar to the
nature
circumstance
of the game? I think it might be also people want you to know that they're too busy to read your play. I think that's part of it. Theatre is a very strange world and not an easy one to get along with. And as I say, I've had only bad experiences. Indeed, the fourth book in the Hawthorne series, The Twist of a Knife, is all about a play, an earlier play of mine put on, which is torn apart by the critics. One in particular, a lady called Harriet Throsby, writes a three-piece diatribe about how useless the writer is. Not many writers since then have had to write that section about themselves, but I did it. She is then murdered.
Of course she is. Of course she is.
Which you probably enjoyed. That murder.
I wouldn't say that. You know, I met a few critics when I was writing the book, and I have no animus against critics, really. I mean, they're doing a job, and it's interesting. I think that, funnily enough, theatre critics have shot themselves badly in the foot by allowing the star system to come in, because now nobody reads a review unless it's one star or five stars.
And that's true.
Two, three, or four stars, you might as well not bother writing anything.
Just en passant, made me laugh out loud. Just needs to be highlighted, I think, in case there are people who've forgotten this classic record. Quote from the book, you're talking, this is Hawthorne and talking to the director, called a guy called Cy Truman. "You've been very helpful, Cyril. Nice one."
Simon, okay. You are the first person to talk about the book to have noticed my little joke. Thank you very much, Cyril.
A hit for the Cockerel Chorus. Of course. Back in the... This is it's a tough question, but I think you can do it, and I think you probably want to do it. I want to talk about the ending, just in a very kind of abstract way, in terms of whether you started with it, how pleased you are with it. Did you always know it was that kind of conversation, and whether it was different to any of the other, because you've written so many murders, so many solutions, revealed so many extraordinary facts and figures and stories and so on. You keep us guessing throughout the entire book. Is it possible to talk about it in a general sense?
Yeah, it is, of course. I mean, the first thing to say is that I always start with the end. People think that I might write these murder mysteries and decide who did it at the end, and there may be writers indeed who do that. Not me. Everything, the construction of the book is very precise. It is worked out to the last dot, you know, really, and every clue is in the right place, and I have a rule that the reader should be able to solve the murder mystery at the same time as or before Hawthorne. And then you come to the reveal itself, and you ask yourself, how are you going to do it? Because if, for example, Hawthorne and I enter this studio and confront you, then before the chapter even begins, we know that you are the killer, and that's what it's going to be about. So how do you disguise that? How do you get away from that? Do you do what Agatha Christie did, a thing that was suggested to her by her publisher, incidentally, Alan Lane? This was his idea, that you have all the suspects in the room at the same time, so that she can, you know, and I've written this scene so many times when I was working for Poirot. It could have been you, or it could have been her, or it might have been him, but actually it was you. And you do that, and you play that game. But I was very proud of the fact that in this case I'm dealing with not one but two murders, and they are many, many years apart, and they all have to be resolved in not one but two chapters, and it's the relationship between those two chapters is unusual, put it that way. And there's something in there which is different that made me smile.
It's one of the hugely enjoyable things about reading your books is that, I mean, I go along for the ride. I don't try and solve it. And I'm always absolutely thrilled that, you know, occasionally you might think, oh, I wonder if it was there. Oh, yeah, it could be there. But actually then when you do your final ta-da, and in fact, there's a double one, I had absolutely not a clue.
Same.
Well, I do. I like to hear that. I'm naughty because I do. I've said to you, I think, more than once that I want people to be able to solve it. But actually, that's not true. I get so angry when they do. And I have a very, very good American publisher, Jonathan Burnham in New York, who is up steeped in Golden Age murder mystery, and he does occasionally guess it. And I always say to him, well, what was it that gave it away? And he'll say, well, it was chapter 17, that thing when she turns the light on. So in chapter 17, I take that out. I dropped that because I just, that's one clue too many. That's what gave it away. But then I'll replace it with something else. There'll be, so there's still plenty of clues in there. But it is a game to play with the reader. And I'm like you. I don't read a murder mystery just for the solution. And when I'm writing them, for that matter, I'm being careful to make the characters fun, to write good language, to have fun scenes like the BAFTA chapter, for example, which has got... Well, not very much to do with the murder, but nonetheless is linked, but in a sort of oblique way, and to enjoy the world, you know, the descriptions of Hastings and of Yorkshire and going up and walking on the dales. I did go up there with my dog, who was sitting in the studio next door, and we had the most wonderful visit, and trying to get some of that love of the environment and the people and the characters and the world into the book as well as just, oh, and it was him.
So I love the idea of being hoodwinked, having the rug pulled from underneath me. What I also love is when I spot that a writer wants me to not like a character, and at one point you have the screenwriter comes in, and she comes in to a meeting late already. I'm like, I'm well against her, but then starts criticizing your writing in front of you, saying you don't really write thrillers that are thrilling, and here's what's wrong with all your work, to the point where you're like, why have you taken this job on? You don't like his writing, you don't like his, why are you doing this?
But the funny thing is, I do quite like, you said, Matt, Simon, you liked her as a character, and I like her too, because, you know, she is what she is, and at the end of it, I like the way she admits, you know, she's basically got to pay her Visa card bills, and so, you know, her credit card bills, and so that's why she's taken the job on. I do love the line she says. She says, your books aren't thrilling in the same way that the Carry On films aren't funny.
That's exactly it.
Oh, thanks. And actually, I quite like the Carry On films, if you don't mind. Because the first book, The Word is Murder, took place in Deal, partly, which is where Charles Hawtrey lived, and I grew up on all that stuff, you know, so this is very much part, you know, her words are sort of, are a knife to my heart, as it were, but even so, I do like her, and I mean, you know, there's no spite or venom in the book because I, you know, I've worked in film and TV for 30, 40 years and I've loved every bit of it. I've met the bad guys as well as the good, but by and large, my experience has been entirely positive.
I was exchanging messages over the weekend with a very successful writer who had a very good review in the papers, and he or she had replied back to me saying, yes, I was very pleased with the review, can't sell anything. It's a really tough world out there. And I was just wondering if you could compare selling books now with, say, 10, 15 years ago. Is it more difficult to sell a book now than it used to be?
I'm not sure I have an answer to that, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, my trajectory has been that ever since Alex Rider broke, I have become a known person within the writing world, which means, and this is something that used to really annoy me when I was a starter writer and was not well known, that the people who don't need it are the ones who get all the publicity. That was what I used to think. Why do they get the interviews? Why do they get all this advertising on the tubes and stuff? You know, they're already bestsellers. What about me? But that's a journey you take. You know, you start and then you write, maybe it's your first book, or in my case, it was my 11th book that actually sort of broke something and got me sort of known. But that journey happens. Now, as to whether it's easier or harder to sell more books these days, what with social media and telephones and all the rest of it, I'm optimistic. I'm up there because, look, at the moment as we speak, I'm number 3 in the bestseller list, which is a nice place to be. I should say, incidentally, that the romanticists and the, you know, the people who are writing fantasy novels and these sort of young TikTok writers are stealing the first and second and third and fourth spots from most of the time. Yeah, I know that. But that is the world we live in, and I can't complain because I've been writing now for, my first book was published, God help me, I mean, almost 50 years ago. Wow. So just still to be in the business, still talking to you guys, still out there, still publishing books, I would hate myself if I was listening to this and I heard myself making any complaint at all. And I also think, incidentally, this sort of, you know, constant feeling that people aren't reading anymore is to a certain extent misplaced. You know, there are figures that show young people seem to be reading less, and things, certainly fashions are changing, and social media is having a terrible impact on the way young people, and actually all people relate to the world. Social media is a cesspit of in many, many ways. But that said, books are still selling. People are still listening, hopefully, to us talking right now about books. I go to book festivals and there are crowds of people who've come out to listen to it. Independent bookshops are increasing in number, not decreasing. So there are signs that, you know, ever since I was ever since I started writing, people have been saying it's over. You know, no books are selling anymore. But somehow here we still are.
Might you be tempted to have a dragon in the next Hawthorne?
Well, a dragon and a naked princess, I think, will certainly help my sales. Yes.
And a fairy porn, I think it's referred to.
Yes, there we go.
So you're not tempted?
No.
Okay, all right. There'll be another bit of our conversation with Anthony in the second part of this podcast, which will be with you in a few days' time. For the moment, Anthony Horowitz, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.